Policy Committee to order. We will begin by taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akin.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Lislegard. Representative Lislegard. Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
We have a quorum present. Members, we have three bills up today. And first, we are going to hear House File 751, which is Representative Akin's bill. Representative Akin, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would. And I would also like to move the A2 amendment, please.
Representative Akin moves House File 751 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Akin also moves the A2 amendment. Would you like to describe your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This amendment just reflects some feedback that came out of some conversations with stakeholders and adds some additional specificity to the optional utility filing that's proposed in the bill.
So Representative Akin has an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. Any discussion to the author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A2 is adopted. Representative Akin, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 751. Those of you who are on this committee last session may remember this bill when it was brought to us by Representative Long. And in reviewing the language for today, you may also recognize that some of the amendments that were added last year by Representatives Swazinski and Meckland were also kept. As review for those of you who are new to the committee, House File 751 creates a framework for utilities, regulators, and energy stakeholders to consider beneficial electrification of the building sector. According to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's most recent greenhouse gas inventory report, the single fastest growing source of climate change pollution in Minnesota is from residential buildings, with commercial buildings not far behind. Left unchecked, these sources have the potential to significantly undermine the progress Minnesota continues to make in the electricity sector. Beneficial electrification for buildings is a critical strategy as we transition to the energy systems of the future. Minnesota's regulated utilities need clear guidance on the objectives and the parameters that will be expected of them as they develop proposals on this subject at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Put another way, we need to define the beneficial part of beneficial electrification. This bill is not a mandate, does not require utilities to do anything, does not assess new costs on utility customers, and does not substantively alter the way utilities and other parties do their business before the commission. I have with me this morning some testifiers who can add more detail and context for the bill. And first, I will introduce Margaret Cherney Hendrick from Fresh Energy.
Ms. Cherney Hendrick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you all. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. My name is Margaret Cherney Hendrick, and I am here on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nearly 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to achieve equitable carbon-neutral economies. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today regarding House File 751. Minnesota has made great progress in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector, but we have fallen behind in making similar progress in other critical sectors of the economy, like transportation and buildings. While we have started to see engagement on advancing decarbonization of transportation systems through electrification, the building sector has received no such attention. There is a particular urgency to clean up emissions from the building sector, as it is now clear from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that the fastest rising sources of emissions in the state are from the residential and commercial building sectors, as Representative Acom mentioned. As of 2005, emissions have risen 32% from residential buildings and 15% from commercial buildings. However, investor-owned utilities and the Public Utilities Commission require guidance on how best to move forward. House File 751 represents an important first step in decarbonizing the building sector by providing utilities with the opportunity to file building electrification plans with the Commission. The PUC already requires utilities to file annual transportation electrification plans, which has resulted in significant progress in advancing utility programs, pilots, and rate structures that decarbonize our transportation systems. House File 751 simply extends the same opportunity to utilities to advance building electrification plans, minus the requirement. Importantly, House File 751 also provides a framework for what constitutes beneficial electrification. Beyond reducing emissions and improving public health, electrification must prioritize investment and activity in low-income and under-resourced communities, maintain or improve the quality of electricity service, maximize customer savings, improve the integration of renewable and carbon-free resources, and prioritize job creation to be considered beneficial. This framework will provide important guidance to utilities and the PUC as we advance electrification in the public interest in Minnesota. As Minnesota utilities make bold commitments to decarbonize our electric supply, now is the time to convert end uses and buildings once powered by greenhouse gas intensive fossil fuels to clean electricity. Electric appliances like heat pumps and induction stoves are extremely energy efficient, safe and healthy, and capable of functioning in cold climates. Building sector electrification is an important tool, not only for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also for improving energy efficiency and lowering energy burden, as well as improving indoor air quality and public safety. Fresh Energy strongly supports House File 751, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Acom, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, up next will be Andy Snope with IBEW 292.
Welcome back, Mr. Snope.
Thank you, Chair Long, and members of the House Climate, Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee for allowing me to testify today on House File 751. My name is Andy Snope. I am the Legislative Director for IBEW Local 292. We represent roughly 5,000 electrical workers who work throughout the state of Minnesota. With the word electrification in the name of this bill, I couldn't say no to testifying to this bill. IBEW Local 292 supports House File 751. This legislation promotes the use of electricity in the building sector. As electrical workers, electrification is what we do. Simply, this proposal, if implemented through a program provided by a public utility with approval from the PUC, would provide jobs for the electrical industry. The IBEW provides training to workers for a career in the electrical industry. When one aspect of our industry experiences a slowdown, another part of our industry in which we are trained may be on the upswing. Our career training helps us to even out those industry declines by providing for diverse skills within our industry. We never ask for public funding for our training. In fact, another element of our success is that our industry prides itself on funding our own training programs at no cost to taxpayers. We have a highly skilled, diverse training program funded by contributions from our members and the contractors we work for. Our members are trained and ready to meet the challenge of building electrification. With the slowdown in investments in private building expansion brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic, this additional work in our industry would be very helpful in putting our members back to work. To that end, we are grateful to Representative Acom for adding the language through the author's amendment to give further consideration to provide job opportunities for local workers. Thank you for allowing me time to testify today, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Snope. Looks like we, Representative Acom, did you have?
Okay. I was just going to say thanks. We stand for questions.
Okay, great. Looks like we have a couple of questions so far. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I I think this is a great bill. I was very supportive of it last biennium. Glad to see it back this year. And I think it's particularly timely that we're having this discussion this week in the wake of mass volatility in the natural gas markets last week and the news that that will lead to huge spikes in bills for our residential natural gas consumers in Minnesota. And I wonder if the author or perhaps Fresh Energy would have a comment on the intersection between this bill and what we saw happening in the natural gas market over President's Day weekend.
Representative Aiken.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representatives Stevenson for the question. And I think I will toss it over to one of our testifiers. I think that you bring up a really good point, though, and I am glad to say that in you know, Minnesota, we have some, we didn't suffer the same issues that they had in Texas, so I'm grateful for the regulations and the way things are handled here in Minnesota. So anyway, with that, we'll turn it over to Fresh Energy.
Ms. Turney Hendrick.
Thank you, and thanks for the question. I think it's a good one and very timely. I know the Utility Commission just held a special meeting to sort of go through exactly what happened, especially purchases on the spot market during the polar vortex event by the gas utilities. And, you know, we saw a sixfold increase in what we were paying. And I think now there's an investigation that's open, at least in Minnesota, because while we did not have service reliability issues, we are going to have pricing volatility consequences. And there are going to be considerations about how ratepayers are going to have to be protected from up to, I think, a $400 increase over, you know, their normal costs come September. And so I know many attorneys, state attorney generals are looking into this. Senator Tina Smith has opened an investigation as well. But I think the short and long of it certainly is that, you know, we're very used to comparing solutions in the building sector to very low natural gas prices. And I think given the polar vortex events are going to be intensifying and increasing in frequency, given climate change, that these occurrences should be planned for, including the price volatility going forward. And electrification certainly offers some consistency and reliability that was not available just in the pricing of fuels over the polar vortex event. So, you know, Representative Stevenson, I think it's a great question and one that we should start thinking about pretty consistently. These are going to be events that are going to be happening much more frequently and are going to affect long-term pricing signals.
Representative Stevenson, any follow-up?
Just two observations, because I think the points that the testifier just made are really, really important about the reliability and consistency in the electrical sector. You know, I wasn't able to watch the PUC hearing in real time on Tuesday. I'm really grateful that you, Chair Long, and Chair Senjum have scheduled a special hearing for us to look at this in more detail tomorrow, because I think it's something that members need to be paying very close attention to. But I did have a chance to review some of the materials and have some discussions with people who participated in the hearing at the PUC. And one of the slides I saw really showed the price of natural gas over a lengthy period of time. And, you know, the spike we saw over President's Day weekend was by far, you know, the biggest event that we've seen in natural gas prices over the last few years. But as the testifier alluded to, these polar vortex events consistently cause spikes in the price of natural gas that while maybe not as dramatic as the one we experienced over President's Day, we can have big impact. And so the reliability and the consistency of supply in our electrical grid, I think, is an advantage. Also, you know, no secret, we don't have natural gas in the ground here in Minnesota, but we do have wind and we do have sun. And so being able to rely on our own energy sources, I think, has some value for Minnesota consumers as well. The last thing I wanted to note, and I know we'll probably talk about this more tomorrow, Mr. Chair, during the special hearing, but the testifier did mention that the gas, the price spikes are up to $400 a night. Just wanted to note that that is entirely correct as it applies to consumers who live within our investor-owned utilities space, CenterPoint, Xcel, and others. But a fair number of Minnesotans get their gas from municipal utilities. And I think my understanding, and it maybe as a preview to tomorrow's testimony, is that the spike in bills that those consumers will see as a result of President's Day could be much, much worse. And it's something that we all are going to have to pay a lot of attention to.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Good points and a good preview for tomorrow's hearing as well. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam, for bringing this bill. And I think it's important and timely, and I appreciated your comments about the transportation sector in particular. And the need to reduce greenhouse gases there. There is a real nexus between buildings and transportation when it comes to electrification. And I was wondering, I appreciate Mr. Snope and the IBEW's commitment and work on this issue. And this is really for Mr. Snope, Mr. Chair. Could you describe some of the jobs? You had talked a lot about opportunities and growth, job growth potential, and your apprenticeships, et cetera, in this electrification sector when it comes to clean energy. Could you describe some of the jobs? And I have a particular interest in electric vehicle infrastructure, but I think it might be helpful to just sort of catalog some of the types of opportunities that you envision.
Mr. Snope.
Chair Long, Representative Hornstein, thank you for your question. In the transportation sector, I think we've been very successful in seeing some of the infrastructure for charging electrical vehicles being built out. Tesla has built a whole network of electrical vehicle chargers in the metro area, as well as along the major corridors. So obviously electricians have participated in building that out, as well as some of the other sectors, meaning like in buildings. I know that the Minneapolis parking facilities, the St. Paul parking facilities have all started to build out electrical vehicle chargers and give discounts for people who, commute with electrical vehicles like the high occupancy vehicle lanes. So we have been privileged to do a lot of that work in that electrification sector. Also, as well as in new residential buildings. It was just back in 2019, I worked on a very large apartment building. Each unit had its own heating and cooling unit, which was kind of a split unit of air source heat pump, as well as a gas furnace within it as well. So this is kind of being built out slowly with kind of a combination of gas units and split units. But this is developing work for us much more so than traditional gas furnaces, because we have a fair amount of work in those heat sources. Just recently, I found out when I did a home energy audit on my home that there's such thing as a heat source electric water heater. I was very intrigued by that. But there again, those are high capacity water heating units that is electrical, and that is work for our members. So we're kind of at the forefront of watching this happen and participating in the training and developing the skills to be participating in this new electrification process.
Thank you so much.
Heat source water heaters, that's exciting. Representative Hornstein, any follow-up?
No, thank you very much. That was really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Snope and Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, we did actually have some of these rolling blackouts in western Minnesota. We had them over in Lincoln County. We had them up, I think, in Moorhead. So this will be, essentially, fuel switching, encouraging fuel switching through the PUC, incentivizing it, this bill. Part of the reason, we say, well, we want to just have our own power. So what are you guys expecting? You honestly believe, from a battery perspective, what percentage of Minnesota homes are currently heated with electricity?
This is a question for Ms. Turney Hendrick.
Sure, and thanks for the question. You know, we're definitely not as many as the highest percentage of homes that are heated by electricity are in the South, actually, which is, you know, not surprising because they have a fairly mild climate. I will say, though, that Minnesota and the Midwest do have a higher percentage of electrified heating systems as compared to other cold climates like the Northeast. While we aren't leading in the country, we certainly aren't behind either. And there are some real opportunities to be able to convert to air source heat pump systems, both for water heating and for space heating. I think, you know, you asked a question about reliability, and we see some real opportunities to be able to demonstrate reliability, especially with the value of this bill in laying out exactly what constitutes, you know, electrification done right. And it's not electrification for the sake of electrification. It's making sure that our buildings are as tight and energy efficient as possible before we electrify our end uses. It's making sure that we do build in those energy storage opportunities, and we continue to green the grid, and we build out and modernize the grid simultaneously. So, you know, this is a very integrated and multi-sector type of energy transition. And I think the value of this bill is it very clearly lays out that we need to be having multiple very different facets kind of fall into place as we electrify. And, you know, there's some real values, air source water heaters were mentioned, in being able to demonstrate sort of load flexibility. And what I mean by that is, you know, with a water heater, you don't need to call it up when you want to take a shower. You can heat that water any time of day, especially when you have the most carbon-free electricity on the grid from wind power, for example. So your carbon intensity of that power use is very low, but then you can use that water whenever you want. And so it forms a sort of storage, a thermal storage system. And the building itself, if it's tight enough, can do the same. Especially in cold climates, the value there is that the heat that you produce, you're keeping in your building for longer. So it's an efficiency gain, and it's a reliability gain in cold climates as well.
Looks like Mr. Eliff had something to add as well. Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to answer Representative Swiezinski's question as to the proportion of housing units in Minnesota that are currently heated with electricity. It's 17%, or it was 17% in 2015, so it's about 1 out of 6.
Representative Swiezinski, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, and just Mr. Chair, I think, you know, I obviously have taken some cursory looks at what's kind of happened in Texas, and it's my understanding that in some of the areas that were deeply affected that saw the greatest issue when their electricity went out was the 60% of homes that are electrified and are heated by electricity. And, you know, I just understand, you know, as a person who has a half mile long driveway, reliability of the grid is exceptionally important. But, you know, having a gas is very good. And I think the issue was that they had to divert their electrical generation natural gas capacity to homes. But the trade-off was then also then they had no electricity then to actually run the furnace in some of these homes. And so that caused a lot of those issues with spikes, and then where they were able to continue generation, that's where you saw a lot of that, because it's, you know, you're competing on the open market for that electricity or that gas. And so those, you know, that, you know, that perfect storm, obviously it doesn't happen, these storms, these cold snaps, especially so far south, are exceptionally rare, but the idea to use that as a reason to electrify Minnesota, I think,
looks like Ms. Turney Hendrick wanted to chime in.
Well, I think the Texas, so those are some great points, Representative, and thank you for making them. I think the Texas situation is unique, of course. As we all know, the grid in Texas is fairly deregulated and only serves the state, and so they do not enjoy the same, you know, resilience and reliability factors that we do, being interconnected to a regional grid, which is MISO, of course. So I think the electric grid in the Midwest is not particularly comparable to Texas. And I do think it's worth noting that there are issues with reliability with gas. You know, one of the issues that we saw in Texas, as you mentioned, is that, you know, we couldn't, you know, move the gas around because the pipes were frozen. You know, two, there wasn't enough gas for the demand that was experienced because, you know, ERCOT did not plan for cold climate issues. We need to start planning for that in the future because these will become more frequent events, even in the South. And I think the third is that, you know, we literally couldn't get gas out of the ground, even in the, you know, oil and gas fields that we had across the country. So there were some real reliability concerns beyond just sort of whether we were diverting for, you know, heating versus electric generation in Texas. And so I do think, you know, Minnesota is uniquely positioned to be more or less susceptible to the same issues just because of our grid. We have a lot of, I think as Representative Long has pointed out, you know, a lot of resources here locally, including wind and growing amounts of solar. And, you know, no one here is arguing that we don't have work to do to build out our grid to be even more resilient. But I do think the value, again, of this bill is that it makes that very clear that this should be an integrated approach if we're going to move forward with electrification. And I think we also can't lose track of the fact that in the building sector, we have a moral obligation to act given the increasing emissions that we see from the building sector. And so these polar vortex events are very linked to the climate change that the buildings are, you know, helping to, you know, accelerate. So we can't afford to not do some amount of building decarbonization and electrification, you know, in Minnesota just makes good sense given all of our resources.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski, go ahead.
And just a final follow-up to folks from Fresh Energy. You said we have a moral obligation to do this in the housing sector. From your estimates, from a scientific standpoint, the amount of CO2 that's emitted by homes in Minnesota that would be eliminated because of this bill, what would you see in real terms in temperature decrease or increase from this bill?
Ms. Turney Hendrick.
So Representative, that's a great question. And it's one where, you know, I'm unfortunately not going to give you an exact degree estimate. And I'll say that because this is an economy-wide issue. So transportation is the largest, you know, source of greenhouse gas emissions, both in the country as well as in Minnesota. The power sector, while we're making gains, is, you know, still we got a long way to go. So in the building sector, I will say, you know, across the country, about 40% of emissions are coming from the building sector alone. So tackling issues with greenhouse gases in the building sector will make a measurable and significant advancement in getting to a carbon neutral economy, which is what the science tells us we need to be working towards. So it's not an answer I can give you, you know, right off the cuff. I'd be happy to follow up with a more detailed answer, but suffice it to say, it's not an insignificant accomplishment, and it's one that we do, I think, because we see rising emissions across this sector, unlike any other sector in the Minnesota economy. It's due a greater degree of scrutiny than we've given in the past.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not really sure who wants to answer this question, but with regards to Texas, I actually have family that works in the energy industry down there. Part of what I was informed is the buildings are not built like we build ours here to withstand these types of temperatures, and that was a big contributing factor. But my question is, what was the first generation, power generation, to fail in this cold snap that they had? What went down first is my question.
Ms. Turney Hendrick?
Another good question, and I unfortunately am not going to be able to answer it. I do know that, you know, power generation, nuclear, you know, as well as, you know, wind turbines were all affected. I do think it's notable that wind for that time of year in Texas was overproducing. So as I understand it, that wasn't the most significant perturbation to the energy system in Texas, but really the limitations around having fuels to be able to generate electricity as well as to distribute to heat were really the largest issues there. And you're absolutely right, and it's a very good point to make, that the building codes are very different and specifically set up to meet the climate in Texas as compared to Minnesota. So our codes are much more rigorous because we have climate zone 6 and 7 to contend with. So there is just a basic difference that our buildings are more insulated and ready to withstand cold climate.
And I'll just add that if the direction you're going, Representative Mecklen, is that wind is to blame, wind was only 13% of the overall problem in terms of energy going offline. So other forms of energy, coal, gas, nuclear, were 5 to 6 times more than wind. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, there was a multitude of issues, but largely they don't have the temperature cold, like that kind of cold like we do, and they don't have the infrastructure to deal with it, whether it be iced up. But it's my understanding that you take off that 13% when they started icing up, it also taxes the other items that are left behind. And then the icing for on the coal piles is my understanding. And it was a trickle down effect of completely overwhelming the natural gas supply. So I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Well, Representative Mecklen, I haven't seen an argument that wind is what led to the problems in coal or gas or nuclear. So that's a new one for me. But I do know that you're right that they haven't done enough planning for cold weather. And I think that Texas is learning that with a change in climate, they're going to have to plan for winters like Minnesota. And frankly, we're going to have to start planning for summers like Texas. And we've done, a better job of winterizing our energy systems than Texas has, which is certainly something that contributed to Texas's energy shortfalls. Representative Stevenson, and then we're going to have to move on to the next bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me one last time. I just couldn't resist. The first thing I wanted to point out, you made the big point that I wanted to make, the 13% point, but I also think it's worth noting this idea that wind can't function in the cold is complete nonsense and fiction when you consider the fact that Antarctic research stations are solely powered by wind turbines. And there are communities in Greenland that are solely powered by wind turbines. The issue is, do you have the right technology for the job? And, you know, Representative Mecklen makes a great point that the real issue here is that the infrastructure that they had in Texas was not prepared for the weather event. Another way of saying that is they didn't have the right kind of energy conservation and efficiency measures that we have here in Minnesota. They hadn't insulated things or taken care of the energy loss that they would experience due to coal, which is yet another reason why he should vote for ECO when it comes to the House floor.
Representative Akam, any closing remarks to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just renew my motion that House File 1256 be laid over.
Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 751, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion.
That's what I meant.
So next we have House File 1256, which is also your bill. Representative Akam, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would, and I have a delete all, a D3 amendment.
Representative Akam moves that House File 1256 be laid over for possible inclusion, and Representative Akam also moves her DE3 amendment. Would you like to describe your amendment, Representative Akam?
Yes, the amendment just reflects the work done with the Department of Commerce and stakeholders to ensure the development of a strong program.
Representative Akam has an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE3 is adopted. Representative Akam, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am happy to have the opportunity to present House File 1256, which will develop the Minnesota Efficient Technologies Efficient Technology Accelerator. This program is modeled after a successful program in, this program is modeled after the successful Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, who we will hear from later in our presentation. The goal of the Minnesota Efficient Technologies Accelerators, or META for short, is to accelerate the deployment of increasingly efficient technologies through initiatives with technology manufacturers, equipment installers, and other key players in the supply chain. The benefits will include cost efficiency, energy savings, consumer bill savings, new opportunities for a skilled and equitable workforce while avoiding unneeded utility infrastructure and significant greenhouse gas emissions. I have some testifiers who will be able to help us better understand this important program. First up is Jamie Fiske with the Center for Energy and the Environment.
Ms. Fiske, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Jamie Fiske with the Center for Energy and Environment. Also with me today is Jeff Harris, Benjamin Stafford, and available for questions is Carl Nelson. As Representative Akam mentioned, House File 1256 would enable a Minnesota Efficient Technology Accelerator, or META for short. An energy efficiency accelerator implements a set of strategies known to efficiency advocates as market transformation. This would be a new concept here in Minnesota, but market transformation has decades of success in other parts of the country. Traditionally, energy efficiency programs in Minnesota have focused on encouraging customers to adopt more energy efficient technologies that are readily available in the marketplace. Rather than work downstream with customers, market transformation works upstream, directly with technology manufacturers to improve the efficiency, cost, and performance of their products, and with the supply chain to accelerate the deployment of increasingly efficient technologies. Through initiatives with technology manufacturers, suppliers, distributors, and equipment installers, we would seek to reduce the market barriers to more efficient products. More plainly said, instead of hoping for better building materials and technology, we work early on with manufacturers to improve the energy efficiency and availability of a product, show that there's a market for those products and services, and then get them into the market sooner. This is first done by identifying specific, high-potential, emerging, and innovative technologies that could benefit Minnesotans, and understand the market barriers, or what's holding this up. Then plan specific ways to reduce those market barriers and maximize opportunities for bringing these innovative and emerging technologies to Minnesota customers. Next is preparing the supply chain, which includes working directly with manufacturers, establishing a supplier pipeline, and workforce training to ensure these highly efficient technologies are available to Minnesotans and there's a skilled workforce to install them. All this leads to bringing innovative, energy-efficient technologies to Minnesota consumers sooner and at a lower cost. In addition, these technologies will provide comfortable living and working spaces along with energy and bill savings. So to provide some context, interest in this stems back to 2018, when the Department of Commerce issued a statewide energy efficiency potential study. This study showed Minnesota has cost-effective efficiency potential for the next decade, but that we needed to think of new ways to capture that potential. This prompted us to broaden our search for efficiency programs to bring to Minnesota and to look deeper at the work the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, or NEA for short, has been doing with their market transformation program. NEA has over 20 years of experience in implementing market transformation programs in Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. The testifier following me, Mr. Jeff Harris from NEA, will provide an overview of market transformation's impact in advancing energy efficiency products and services to utility customers in the Pacific Northwest. A few of those examples are highlighted in the one pager provided to the committee. Realizing that Minnesota was missing a key energy efficiency initiative here, we began researching and vetting what is needed for a successful market transformation program in Minnesota. Over 18 months ago, CEE began informal and formal meetings with NEA and key Minnesota stakeholders, such as electric and natural gas utilities, the Department of Commerce, to discuss why a Minnesota market transformation program is needed and what a program could look like. So META is a very Minnesotan way of approaching innovation. Instead of passively waiting for energy efficiency technologies, products, and workforce to arrive, we invest further upstream in the process to capture opportunities that fit Minnesota's needs. META can maximize program efficiency by aggregating utility funding and leveraging the buying power and market potential of 6 million Minnesotans, as opposed to a one-off approach. And of utmost importance is creating a focus on Minnesota. We have unique climate and building needs and have to ensure the cold climate technologies we need will not be ignored. I'd like to stress that traditional energy efficiency programs are immensely successful. And while we are achieving SIP goals now, Utilities have raised concerns to where future energy efficiency savings, say in the next 5 to 10 years, may come from. Meta technologies will be forerunners to future programs and lay the groundwork for the next generation of energy efficiency programs, ensuring Minnesotans will have opportunities to control their energy bills and use energy more efficiently in the future. We're bringing this legislation forward as it will allow an aggregated statewide program. Legislation like this exists in the SIP statute for certs and similar statewide programs that aren't utility specific. With this bill, we are looking to enable a strong and successful market transformation program in Minnesota while establishing filing qualifications, stakeholder engagement requirements, and setting parameters to help ensure a successful and well-run program. Also looking to establish a funding mechanism through SIP, which is based on existing utility SIP budgets, ramping up gradually for the first years of the program. This legislation incorporates recommendations we've received from Commerce to establish a pre-filing process that includes significant stakeholder engagement to work through important details prior to submitting a full proposal, such as how we plan to measure and track cost-effective energy savings for Minnesota customers and how to allocate those back to participating utilities. META will prevent stagnation by actively looking for new, innovative, energy-efficient technologies and practices to make available to Minnesotans, in addition to preparing the supply chain needed for success, and recognizing multiple barriers exist through the efficiency chain. And without intervention, progress is impeded, and that wastes money, wastes energy, and delays future innovation, which contribute to increased customer costs. Minnesota ranks number 9 nationally in energy efficiency, the only Midwest state in the top 10, and is home to a number of Fortune 500 companies, innovative startups, and technology companies. Minnesota has an intelligent and driven workforce, but we also have shortages in some key areas of technical skills workforce. And we value energy efficiency as a resource. It has been a cornerstone of utility resource planning, and Minnesota has avoided building multiple large power plants because of its cost-effective investments in energy efficiency. We now have the opportunity to ensure that Minnesota stays at the forefront of utilizing this valuable energy resource. Minnesota is well positioned to be a leader in market transformation and bringing innovative, low-cost, energy-efficient technology to businesses and homes across the state, enabling us to use energy more efficiently, even in the harshest conditions, which saves utility customers money, makes businesses more competitive, and homes comfortable and safe. My deepest thanks to Representative Akam for authoring this bill and to the committee members for their time. Thank you.
Representative Akam, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce Jeff Harris from the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance.
Mr. Harris, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Long and committee members. I'm pleased to be here and to represent the success that we've had here in the Northwest. I have just a few slides, so I'm going to share my screen here to at least provide some visual representation of what we've experienced in the Northwest regarding market transformation as a successful way to enhance energy efficiency in the Northwest. So the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, by the way, I am the Chief Transformation Officer at NEA. And I've been at NEA from its very inception back in the late 1990s. And so I've been on this journey of trying to understand how we can effectively use market transformation as a tool to accelerate market adoption of energy efficient technologies and practices. The Energy Efficiency Alliance is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. And we have over 140 utilities in 4 states that fund us voluntarily on 5-year funding cycles to provide stable platform funding for these interventions that we do in markets. We have the utilities that you see the logos for here. The main thing I'd like to point out is that we have both gas, natural gas, and electric utility funding, as well as federal agencies such as the Bonneville Power Administration, a large federal wholesaler, and some municipals and cooperatives. We have a whole range of energy delivery agencies that fund us. We have an annual budget of around $35 million a year to do the work that we do, but that includes some market research and other things that we do on behalf of the region. So that's who we are. Ms. Fitzke already represented, market transformation to us has a simple definition and a more complex definition. I'll give you the simple one here in the interest of time. It's the strategic process of intervening in a market to create lasting change. And every one of those green highlighted phrases is important to us and important to the concept of market transformation. It is strategic. It is a process, meaning that it's not a one-time purchase of anything. This is something where you have a long-term strategic view of what the market can do and what needs to be done to make it more efficient. And intervening in a market is another important phrase. Market transformation recognizes the incredible power that markets bring to the area of energy consumption and energy efficiency. And if those powerful forces can be harnessed to take energy efficiency along with them, then the market itself can do much of the work. And this is part of what the fundamental concept of market transformation is about. It's working with markets to ensure that we have a more efficient future. And the lasting change is the last piece of that. We don't want these interventions to be one and done. We want them to represent structural change in markets so that we don't have to go back and revisit that those markets are changed forever. So I will skip the long form version of that. And I would be remiss if I didn't show you the famous S-curve picture. It's famous in our region because we show this pretty much anytime we are presenting about market transformation in the Northwest region. I don't have time to go into all the details here, but this is a graphical representation of what Ms. Fitzke presented to you about the concept of market transformation. But maybe the simplest thing to say is that what we are trying to accomplish through market transformation is that we want to bring new innovative technologies into the market, which is in the lower left-hand corner of this graph. Many people will classify this as the land of emerging technologies. And the traditional utility program world has done a pretty good job of developing emerging technologies and proving that they work. But what we've been challenged with is to get them to the upper right-hand corner of the graph, which is we want those emerging technologies to be able to be widely adopted by the marketplace as far as possible, in fact. And the process of market transformation is working on the barriers, market barriers, and market opportunities. Once we find the emerging technology, we want to take those things and remove the barriers and exploit those opportunities so that they become business as usual. And if we're successful in that, we believe that we can not only increase the amount of energy efficiency that's adopted by the marketplace, but we can lower the cost substantially of that as the market does what it does best. Once the market embraces things, we have an amazing industry these days that can produce things at scale for very low cost. But it's the challenge is getting to scale. And so what we've done over the last 20 years at NEA is work on that problem of trying to work with the market, work with industry, manufacturers, distributors, retailers, to get products to scale so that we can lower the cost to all participants in the market. We have had success in applying this technique of market transformation to a whole variety of products and services over the last two decades. We started all the way back in the late 1990s, as I mentioned, and we worked on things that are now kind of quaint as we think about them, but front-loading clothes washers, for example, which were a very low market share back in the day of 1997, and now are ubiquitous. It's a standard product in the marketplace today. Back then, we didn't have light-emitting diode technology for lighting, but we had compact fluorescent lamps, and they were very expensive, very ugly, didn't work very well. And now today we have LED lamps that are as good or better than the incandescent lamps that they replace. And they use, 70% less energy. We've worked on industrial motor systems. We've worked on things like windows. We've worked on electronics, new homes. And we've done management practices in industrial and commercial facilities using strategic energy management and developed that as a practice that could be widely adopted into the marketplace. Some things on here of particular note to, I think, Minnesota are we worked on ductless, what we refer to as ductless heat pumps. Some people call them mini splits, but we have a lot of electric resistance heat in our region for historical reasons. And we saw an opportunity to vastly improve the efficiency of those homes using ductless heat pump technology. That is now producing that works very well in cold climates. And we have some 6 and 7 climate zone locations in our region, in Montana in particular. It gets very cold there. And we have proved that this technology can indeed work in those markets. I know I'm running long on time here, so I'll quickly go to my next slide. Just to summarize, having worked on all those technologies and all those products and successfully increased their market adoption, that market adoption can be translated directly into increased energy efficiency for our Northwest region. And those savings have resulted in 9,000 gigawatt hours per year at this point. That's enough energy to serve the city of Seattle each year. So that's a very big accomplishment. That represents, though, I want to put it in context, the Northwest, as does Minnesota, we have a very robust utility-funded energy efficiency program environment. And those efficiency programs, traditional utility rebate programs, represents the lion's share, as you can see in the pie chart there. Over roughly 60% of all the energy savings in the Northwest are attributable to those utility rebate programs. The market transformation effort has delivered about 17% of the Northwest regional energy efficiency results over the last two decades. But the cost of that market transformation effort has been only about 8% of the total expenditure of public funds on energy efficiency in the region. So it's been a very good investment for the region. And the untold story there is that, frankly, much of the other slices of the pie, including the 60% or 58% of utility program savings, has a direct linkage to the technologies that we've developed through market transformation that are now in programs and are available for rebates through utility programs. Things like ductless heat pumps. We did the very hard initial work to get that into the market.
Mr. Harris, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up, if you don't mind.
Oh. That was my last slide. Thank you very much, Chair Long.
Thank you so much, Mr. Harris. Representative Aiken, would you like to introduce your final testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Last up, we have Benjamin Stafford with Clean Energy Economy Minnesota.
Mr. Stafford, welcome to the committee.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Stafford. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led nonprofit organization representing the business voice of clean energy here in Minnesota. We work to help educate Minnesotans about the economic benefits of transitioning to a clean energy economy. Our membership consists of over 40 clean energy companies, ranging from startup businesses to Fortune 100 and 500 corporations. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 1256 and the proposed Minnesota Efficient Technology Accelerator. The clean energy business community supports this bill. The aim here is acceleration of energy waste reduction and energy efficiency technologies while reducing the costs of employments, i.e. business costs. We welcome the idea of a venue for engagement with private sector partners like they've had and we've discussed so far. Energy waste reduction is becoming a more critical component of this clean energy transition, and it's important to build partnerships connecting market opportunities with technical resources, with supply chains, with customer-facing professionals. All of this is helping to speed the speed to market for promising energy efficiency solutions here in Minnesota. Investments in energy waste reduction are also a down payment on good jobs for Minnesotans. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Minnesota was home to over 61,000 clean energy jobs, and these were growing at 2.5 times the rate of the rest of the economy whole, according to the 2020 analysis in our Clean Jobs Midwest report. And this growth has brought benefits to all corners of the state, with 37% of those jobs in greater Minnesota. I bring that up because on top of all that, efficiency jobs, much like efficiency solutions, are almost inherently local. Neighbors helping neighbors save energy, save money, use energy more effectively. We know that such a program must be also cost-effective for ratepayers, ultimately lowering the cost for Minnesota's energy consumers. The idea of META here is designed to complement existing efficiency expertise and build new expertise as topics emerge. This adds to Minnesota's successful conservation efforts, which have made our state a leader both in the region and nationally. Minnesota can advance the adoption of energy efficiency products, services, practices, and approaches. And we strongly support this bill from the business community and would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stafford. We do have an amendment filed, coded A1. Representative Swazinski, are you moving the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Swazinski moves the A1. Can you please describe your amendment?
Yes. So what the amendment does is, you know, you've got that this would be potentially renewed every 5, and it switches it to 3 years. And I think that maybe is a little bit better because it would actually coincide a little bit closer with other plans that are submitted to the PUC, just from a timing standpoint, rather than 5 years, 3 years, I think is a time scale that utilities work with. And I think actually would make a little bit more sense. I still potentially disagree with the whole concept of this bill, but I think actually having it work within the parameters that are already set in place, this amendment would help set with those same things. And I'd appreciate your support.
Discussion amendment, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swazinski for the amendment. I think that market transformation involves products and services that aren't yet developed or readily available in the market. Therefore, a longer time frame is needed to do research and vet technologies, work with manufacturers, and build a successful portfolio of technologies. So while I appreciate the sentiment, I would suggest a no vote.
Further discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, I don't think you need to negate the fact that, you know, this can also be re-upped in 3 years. It's not that, you know, that's a danger that, you know, if this bill would somehow become law, that the legislature in 3 years couldn't actually look at the real work that's being done by this and say, you know, absolutely. But, you know, if the goalposts aren't being met, I mean, why consider poor, you know, why consider keeping taxes high on ratepayers to pay for this when it's potentially not getting the job done? I think, you know, having good, I mean, we've seen the issue with not having legislative oversight with executive orders and the rest. And I think we need to keep all these bureaucratic jobs in check. And I think it's our duty as legislators to have those timelines as short as possible. So I would actually ask that you do support the bill.
Seeing no further discussion to the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Aye. No.
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 The noes have it, the amendment is not agreed to. Discussion to the bill. I do not see, Representative Franzen. Representative Franzen.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I completely forget to unmute. So to House File 1256, I'm wondering, Representative Acorn, how did you arrive at the years of experience necessary to administer this program? Why 25 years? Why not 10 or 15 years? And how many nonprofit organizations in Minnesota meet the 25-year threshold?
Representative Acorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Franzen, for the question. And I don't know how many organizations would fit that qualification. I think what we wanted to ensure is that the organization that ultimately ends up overseeing this program has a long history of effective work in this space.
Representative Franzen, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have.
Leave the door open.
Grunhagen, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that said, Representative Acorn, why is this not being done through the competitive bidding process by an agency like DEED that has experience with the business accelerators?
Representative Acorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think it's being done through the Department of Commerce because they have experience in this space as well, setting up programs in this energy space.
Representative Franzen.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I think is happening with this bill is that this program is going to be run by the Nonprofit Center for Energy and the Environment. And that's why we have this 25-year experience needed. So I'm just wondering how much will the Center for Energy and Environment receive underneath this bill?
Representative Acorn.
There, This bill is not directed toward a specific organization, but one to go through a process with the Department of Commerce to determine the best fit to administer this program. So there isn't an answer to your question. There is nothing in the bill that is directing money toward CEE.
Representative Franzen, and then we'll have to move.
Thank you, Representative Long. So I am wondering what the utilities are doing with the money that will be diverted then to the organization that you believe is not the Center for Energy and the Environment.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The money that will fund this program is what's currently going to the SIP program, and it's a portion of that that will be used to fund the accelerator program.
One final question.
final. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the limit on administrative fees for the nonprofit?
Representative Akam.
What is the limit on administrative? I'm not sure that I recall. If that might be in the bill, I don't recall the specific.
Does anybody have specifics on that?
Ms. Fitzke.
Chair Long, Representative Franzen, I believe some of these would be determined through the Department of Commerce through the filing process. As you can see within the bill, there is a significant stakeholder engagement with this, and there's even like a pre-RFP filing process that takes place through this. So a lot of these things would be determined through the department with the utilities input and other stakeholders.
Thank you, Ms. That was your final, Representative Franzen.
then I move to lay the bill on the table, and I'd like a roll call.
Representative Franzen moves to lay the bill on the table and asks for a roll call. That's a non-debatable motion, and the chair votes no. The clerk will take the roll.
Vice Chair Akam.
No.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Yes.
Representative Bierman.
No.
Representative Bo.
Yes.
Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Franzen.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Igo?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
Lee, no.
Representative Lippert?
No.
Representative Lislegard?
No.
Representative Meckland?
Yes.
Representative Munson? Representative Stevenson?
No.
There being 6 ayes and 10 noes, the motion to lay it on the table is not agreed to. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can somebody answer, like, how much money does the Center for Energy and Environment currently get per year from the utilities?
If the question is to the Center for Energy and Environment, I'll refer that to Ms. Fitzke.
Representative Meckland, or sorry, Chair Long, Representative Meckland. We do facilitate some conservation improvement program contracts through multiple utilities. I'll have to get back to you on what the exact amount of that is. So I'm happy to come back to you with that, but we are a program implementer. We do research and development, education, interest loans for small businesses. So I'm happy to get you a breakdown of the percentage of where that falls.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question, whether it's the Center for Energy and Environment or some other nonprofit, what results would they have to demonstrate to have their funding renewed going forward?
Representative Akam, would you like to take that?
Sure. I think they would have to be showing that they're providing a successful program.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just this money is just kind of a finite amount. If this money is diverted to this program, whether it's CEE or another group that gets the grant award, two questions: how many jobs will it create within that organization? And then two, are the utilities on with this? What work will this money not accomplish in other places that it's currently accomplishing? is obviously we've been told that all this money needs to be get generated because it's so necessary, but now we're going to take $5 million of it and divert it to something else. What work won't get done that's currently being done with that $5 million?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. I think that as we heard from Mr. Stafford, that there are a lot of jobs and that the industry is very supportive of this because of the jobs that it's going to create. And as far as what it will be preventing from happening, the impetus of the accelerator is that it will make more energy efficiencies happen. And so if it's being successful, it will amplify how those investments are being done now, or how those allocations are being, how effective they are now. It will make them more effective if the program is being successful.
Representative Swazinski, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So let's say the $5 million is currently being spent on insulating buildings, replacing motors. So that work would not happen, but we'd be looking at creating jobs would the $5 million be all bureaucrats that are hired with the $5 million? Like, would we create 25 jobs at $100,000 a year? Like, what would be the, like, you know, or would they be actually giving grants then of that $5 million?
Looks like Mr. Elef is coming to our aid. Mr. Elef.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I'll be aiding anybody. I'm looking at the language that begins on line 226, which outlines the contributions from utilities to this new organization. And although they use to measure those contributions, the percentage of the utilities SIP spending that's approved in the plan by the commission, it's unclear whether this money is being diverted from SIP or if it's supplemental to SIP. I just don't think that's clear in the language, although Ms. Fiske probably has an idea of how they view it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Swazinski.
To speak to the author of the bill, is her intention to raise additional $5 million of SIP money? So essentially, you know, inflate the cost of electricity by another $5 million, or is it to take from the current allocation pool?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The intention of the program is to use what's currently being put into SIP and take it and use it to be even more effective.
It looks like Ms. Fiske would like to respond as well. Ms. Fiske.
Thank you, Chair Representative Swazinski. So the plan is to either allow utilities flexibility, where maybe they have a program right now that isn't meeting its goals and there's some budget flexibility available. So then a utility could defer some of that funding from that, or they could request some budget flexibility from the Department of Commerce in order to fund a market transformation program. With that in mind, funding would not be taken away from programs that are successfully reaching their goals and successfully reaching customers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski, and then we'll have to move on for time. Representative Swazinski.
These are very good questions. I mean, this is good stuff we're finding out. So essentially what Ms. Swazinski said is that if the utilities can say that current programs aren't being successful, they are allowed to take it. But if not, then they are to request that they would be able to have to raise additional funds from ratepayers. Are utilities on the line right now that can speak to any programs that they feel are being inefficient that they would utilize today to fund this? Or are we just saying that with the idea that they'll be forced to raise rates on utility players through the PUC?
No utilities signed up to testify today, so you'd have to ask them directly. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really briefly wanted to comment that I find the nature of this discussion actually pretty unfortunate because I think, you know, there's been some suggestion by members of the committee that there's something inappropriate about the way this is being set up or that money's being inappropriately steered and to one not-for-profit. And here we have a proposal from Representative Akam that sets up a process for the commissioner to pick a not-for-profit. You know, people should know that throughout state government, partner with not-for-profits all the time and often list them directly by name in the budget, okay? Make a direct appropriation for not-for-profits. That's very common in the jobs budget. As Commerce Chair, I can tell you it's in the Commerce budget that we directly partner with not-for-profits that are named directly. In this case, you have instead an open process that people could apply for. To me, sort of in. So I just think it's really the rhetoric and the insinuations that are being made are really unfortunate.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative Grunhagen, briefly, and then we'll need to move on to our next bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this is for Representative Akam. Who wrote the DE3 amendment? What organization or group?
Representative Akam.
I worked with CEE, as well as the Department of Commerce, and other stakeholders had input on it as well.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Akam, do you have any closing comments to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, I urge the committee support.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 1256 as amended be laid over. Our final bill for the day is has been posted to our committee website, and it is Representative Bierman's bill. Representative Bierman, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for providing the time for this hearing. I just want to start with that we have all seen the news on MPCA's greenhouse gas emission inventory report showing transportation is now the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, which are a driving force in climate change. To reduce these emissions, Minnesota needs to accelerate its adoption of lower emission vehicles and zero emission vehicles. At this same moment, automotive manufacturers around the globe are committing to electric vehicle production as their future. In China, all new vehicles will be electric within 15 years. Some European countries are ending sales of gasoline vehicles by 2030. Jaguar will be all EV by 2025. Ford is spending billions on new electric models. GM has just announced that it will phase out combustion engines by 2035. Tesla is far ahead and dominating the electric car revolution that has arrived. What will it mean for the way we live and how we build? This coming transformation in transportation has an immediate impact the need of homeowners and renters across the state. Since 80 to 90% of EV charging is done at home, we should plan accordingly. Charging stations in existing homes will need to be retrofitted one house at a time, but we should begin the process of transition on all new single-family and multifamily housing construction by incorporating the electric infrastructure necessary for EVs in every new unit now. This would be forward-thinking, logical policy to put the basic infrastructure in place to meet the electric vehicle transition on our horizon. Such a policy will add a cost for the building construction industry, but for every unit built, it would be safe to assume the cost would be double to add this needed feature after the fact, and it will be needed in a relative short order. My bill will alleviate some of those challenges and costs by pre-setting the infrastructure necessary for future homeowners. Mr. Chair, I'd like the opportunity for a few testifiers. I think you have the list of them, and we can hear their comments, and then we can go to member questions, please.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. First up, I believe, is Brendan Jordan. Mr. Jordan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute, and I represent Drive Electric Minnesota. Drive Electric Minnesota is a partnership of a number of players in the EV industry in Minnesota, including utilities, automakers, auto dealers, and nonprofit organizations and charging companies. Generally speaking, the reason this issue is important is because it's cheaper to do these things up front. Adding conduit in advance to allow the addition of EV charging at a later date is much easier when you're doing construction than to try to retrofit later and have expenses related to drilling through concrete, long distance trenching, and other issues to try to retrofit. So this is a type of policy that's being put forward in a number of different jurisdictions around the country. It seems like a common sense step. I do think there's probably some nuances to look at around, there's places where you maybe need one circuit for two parking spaces and things like that. And so there's probably some tweaks here and there, but generally speaking, this is a logical step for the state to pursue.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Next up is Mr. Dean Taylor. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long, for allowing me to speak and testify on this EV Ready Building Code bill. My name is Dean Taylor. I'm a senior policy advisor for Plug-in America, which is a national nonprofit, almost 20 years old, as the voice of the EV driver. And we're also the sponsor of two national EV education weeks every year, as well as several annual reports on EVs. The EV Ready Building Codes are one of the most effective and low-cost strategies for state governments to encourage the adoption of electric vehicles. Numerous studies have shown that EV Ready Building Codes support this expansion and can save consumers thousands in installation costs. There's examples of EV Ready Building Codes in Atlanta, Chicago, Seattle, Honolulu, and states such as Oregon, Massachusetts, and Washington. A recent study found installing EV friendly wiring at the time of construction can be 64 to 75% less than not doing it, saving around $7,000 to $8,000 per parking space in infrastructure costs per parking space. We support this bill on EV Ready Building Codes and believe this is an important step, for Minnesota. Thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Next, we will hear from Ben Rabe. Mr. Rabe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak on this issue today. For the record, my name is Ben Rabe, and I'm the Director of Building Performance at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy strongly supports electric vehicle readiness in the building code. As a member of the ongoing technical advisory group for the new commercial energy code, we are supporting an amendment to require EV-ready spaces in new commercial and larger multifamily buildings. We believe that the administrative code adoption process led by the Department of Labor and Industry is the best and most appropriate path for continuing this conversation. The reason to include EV charging in the building code is clear. The transportation sector, as others have said, is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, with passenger vehicles contributing to the majority of these emissions. Electric vehicles are one solution, and charging vehicles at home during nighttime hours, when the most carbon-free renewable wind is on the grid, is the most cost-effective and lowest carbon intensity way of operating an electric vehicle. Minnesota has a goal of electrifying 20% of its passenger vehicles by 2030. This means owners and tenants of buildings should plan now to add more EV charging space to new building, as it's vastly cheaper, as others pointed out, to include the conduit and electrical capacity for such charging infrastructure during the initial construction process rather than retrofitting. A 2018 study found that across building types, providing EV-ready spaces during construction resulted in an average of 85% cost savings over retrofitting. Planning now will save building owners money and effort in the future while ensuring Minnesotans are ready to have access to an electric vehicle future. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rabe. Mr. Bierman, any additional comments? Oh, excuse me, we have one public comment. Mr. Andy Snope, welcome to the committee. Mr. Snope, I think you have to unmute.
Thank you, Chair Long. My name is Andy Snope, and again, I'm with IBEW Local 292. We represent about 5,000 electrical workers that work all over the state of Minnesota. And on the outset, this is a great idea, being in the electrical industry, thinking forward and getting this infrastructure in place, well before the need arises. If a tenant of a multi-family house or a single-family residence wants to add an EV. However, I guess I would caution and say that, going through the regular code adoption process, is probably a better way to go. I know the National Electric Code writing panels have been working on this issue for the last couple code writing times. The National Electric Code is adopted every 3 years, and currently there is a code within the National Electric Code that requires that 120 volt outlets are installed in single family homes at each garage stall. That's really just a start, and we know that's probably not the most efficient use of power at such a low voltage and amperage, but they are continuing that study. And, you know, I believe in a few years that there will be more of an opportunity to weigh in on that and boost that power that's required. So it is the code writing adaptation of this particular issue would bring together industry experts, and not just in the electrical industry, but home builders, all those interested parties, manufacturers, serve on those panel writing committees. And all these ideas culminate there to write a national electric code that everybody can educate themselves on and implement through that process. So while it's a great idea, I would urge some caution in getting too far ahead of ourselves without further industry input to develop a way to involve everybody in the industry. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Snope.
Mr. Looks like, Chair.
Representative Bierman.
I just wanted to remind you about this bill being something that might engender some conversation and be a conversation starter. And Mr. Snopes has come up with some very good points. And judging by the number of people who want to speak, it has started the conversation. So let's go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Looks like we have seven members who would like to speak, and we have about 7 minutes. So we'll be at about a minute per member. If we can keep it to that, everybody will get a chance to speak. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, what for the residential rehab, how much money would need to be spent in a home for this to kick in?
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, I believe in the bill it lists the size of a remodel being approximately half the unit being remodeled. So that's a very good question, and I think it might be dependent perhaps on the value of a home or what the increase or remodel would be, and would have to be more of a case by case. But I think in the bill it lists about half of the home to be remodeled.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick follow-up to that. One of the last committees that was in tax is talking about affordable housing and how, you know, right now at the veterans at Fort Snelling, we're spending $1 million per unit for a home that's going to be bringing in, you know, $1,200. Would you require there to be prevailing wage done on any of this work with this bill? Or would you, I mean, I think there's real concern that, you know, every single time there's a code change, it's real costs. And if we've got whole committees dedicated to affordable housing with people that don't even own vehicles. And if you're going to require this for multi-family units in places where maybe a third or less than that actually own a vehicle or use a vehicle, all that cost is just going to get leaped onto everyone's rent and not even be utilized. So I think there's some real concern with this.
Representative Bierman.
I appreciate Chairman Long and Representative Swazinski. You make some really good points. And I see, you know, I was on the housing committee in my first term, and so I know about the affordable housing issue and the needs across this state for, you know, lower income housing in particular, and what is affordable housing. So we've had that debate with Housing First repeatedly about what is affordable housing. So I'm not trying to increase the cost of housing by any means on anybody, but I think this need is upon us, and it's something that we're going to have to address and have a forward-thinking policy about it. Builders are already offering it in some cases where people request it, but it is, you know, not usually asked for small builders. your question about prevailing wage, I think, you know, cuts right to the chase. The building industry is expansive, larger projects. Certainly, I would think prevailing wage would be important, but for small builders and, you know, more rural areas, I don't know that that would really apply in all cases. But this, you know, this isn't one of those onerous costs for that would change dramatically the price of a house. So I think it's pretty modest. I've heard rates as low as $200 to $500. So on a small single family.
Representative,
I could go on, but we got more questions. So thank you for that.
We do. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a really quick comment. Thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this, because this is an excellent bill. I strongly support it. And, you know, I carried a very similar bill in 2013, I believe. We'll have to double check the date, but I think it was around then. And, you know, that's 8 years ago, and we are having the same arguments. We're having the same discussion. And the fact of the matter is, it's 8 years later. There's many more electric vehicles. Climate change has accelerated, and we still have not used this time to get it right. And I don't want to wait another 8 years. So I appreciate your bringing this bill forward. It's a good bill, and I would just encourage folks, let's get on with it. This is really important, and I don't think I think the problems that have been raised can easily be addressed.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I tend to agree with Mr. Snopes. We need industry input on this bill. You know, just I would encourage all committee members on both sides of the aisle to do research on the development of electric vehicles. And I don't have time to go into the researchers as much of the credentials, but one particular article says electric vehicles are lauded as an environmentally friendly alternative to gas-powered cars, thanks in part to producing no emission on the road. Yet building electric cars creates more greenhouse gas emissions than producing an equivalent gas-powered vehicle. So you're actually creating more pollution and more problems. And so much like the rest of the Green New Deal, it actually causes more problems with our environment than it actually solves. So if the author of the bill has any comment on that.
Representative Bierman, I suspect that Mr. Jordan and Mr. Taylor could also speak to that.
Sure, let's throw that one over to Mr. Jordan.
All right, Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I don't have time to first of all, I'm not sure the specific study you're referencing, but I'd be happy to provide numerous studies demonstrating that although there is certainly some incremental greenhouse gas emissions related to manufacturing an EV, because of the need to manufacture batteries, that by no means makes EVs worse than, you know, for their full life cycle than a gasoline car. There are multiple studies showing the opposite, that in fact, any incremental emissions related to manufacturing are offset in the early time period of the life of a vehicle. And over the life of the vehicle, they do indeed offer greenhouse gas reductions.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is good discussion, and I'm glad it's coming forward. So thank you, Representative Bierman. Question for you. I heard something briefly about cost, but I'm wondering is that just for the 40-amp, 240-volt service, or is that actually for a charging station or multiple charging stations? Out in suburbia, three-car garages are becoming more the norm. So might we need to have three charging stations in there, and would that require actually a larger electric hookup as well? Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bowe, for the question. You know, I think that the actual cost would vary place to place and based on the size of the house and the numbers needed. My quote was really just for one station or getting the wiring to the garage space so it wouldn't be completely finished and ready for an EV. You'd have to put in your charger if you get a Tesla or whatever you're going to utilize there. If it's just a plug, that number of about $200 to $500 would be the firm cost to get one plug. I would think two might be slightly higher, but not double for a new construction. Whereas a friend of mine just got an EV hookup put in the garage, and it was $1,000 in their existing home. So it's quite a difference.
Representative Akam, we'll have the last question, unfortunately, because we're out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I just was kind of what Representative Bierman was just mentioning is my experience as a single family homeowner, just retrofitted the wiring in my garage to be available for an electric car charger. And so I completely understand the expense of retrofitting in existing, and so appreciate the notion of changing our building codes to accommodate and to look toward the future. Wondering if there is any thoughts about doing that in single family home construction as well.
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, yes, this would be for single family homes and multifamily construction.
Sorry, I misunderstood. So, yes. I thought it was just multifamily. Thanks.
Sure.
You bet. Thank you, Representative Bierman. We are out of time, members. Thank you so much for a great discussion today. I do want to mention that tomorrow at 3:30 p.m., we are having a joint hearing with the Senate Energy Committee on the topic of gas price spikes that we've experienced recently. We're not hearing any bills or taking any votes. It will just be informational, but would certainly encourage members to attend. We'll be hearing from the chair of the Public Utilities Commission, the acting commissioner of commerce, and the attorney general, among others. And with that, we are adjourned.